Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, O God of love and wisdom, send down thy blessing upon all here assembled. Guide those who learn and those who teach, and all who enable them to do each. Save us from academic arrogance and self-worshipping pride, and keep us in our search for truth from all error and desire of vain glory. Accept our thanks for the lives of all who have brought each to this day, and keep us ever in thy way through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Good morning. I'm very happy to have the opportunity of welcoming you to this 38th commencement of the University of Alaska. Again, we have another beautiful day, and this is a very glorious occasion. We'd like to start the program this morning by saying welcome home to the alumni who are here. Particularly, we're honoring today the alumni of the class of 1940, our graduates of the foundation of our university. And their success is a measure of the success of the university. To the members of the class of 1940 who are our guests today, we are most honored to have you back. And we hope that your visit to the campus will revive pleasant memories of yesteryear, that you will have the opportunity to visit with old friends, and that the rapid development in the university will implant a still greater pride in your alma mater, the University of Alaska. I'm going to call the roll of those who are here today. Only a small fraction of the class are so widely scattered over the world that only a small fraction of the class could be here. But I'm going to call the roll of those who are here as our guests. And as I call each name, will you please stand and remain standing? And please withhold your applause until all are standing. And then we'll give them a round of applause. Morris Butler. Mary Egan Cook. Richard Downey, Harry Dwayne Hall, Hendrik W. Johansson, generally known as Woody Johansson, Lee Link. I don't know whether Mr. Marks, Joe Marks, is here or not today. Yes, fine. Thank you, Mr. Marks. Betty Herring Winifrey. Now, I think these are the members of the 1940 graduating class who could be with us this morning. And I think they deserve a round of applause. Our commencement speaker this morning is the Honorable E.L. Bartlett, Senior Senator from Alaska. We all know him as Bob. I first knew him when he was a student here on our campus. This was at the time when he was courting his wife, Vidy. And it was all planned that Vidy would be here with him today, but due to illness, she's unable to come with him. You know, I'll tell you a secret. I didn't want Bob to go into politics. For I felt that he had a great flair for writing. He showed that flair when he was a student here, and I always kept urging him to develop that flair. He, however, didn't heed my advice, and as a result, he's made a far greater contribution to Alaska than if he had written the great Alaskan novel. If you think the life of a dedicated senator is a bed of roses, just try to follow Bob around a typical day in Washington. One week when I was there, he was in his office at 6 o'clock in the morning to get his correspondence handled before a crowd of visitors and seekers descended upon him. How he ever found time to brief himself for committee and floor work is a mystery to me. Bob, all Alaskans, irrespective of party politics, appreciate the wonderful job that you are doing for Alaska, and we welcome you home this fine May morning.
Thank you very much. President and Mrs. Patty, Governor and Mrs. Egan, President Rasmussen, members of the Board of Regents, members of the faculty, members of the graduating class of 1940, friends, but chief among all, the graduates of 1960. My memories stir on this hilltop campus, fond memories of long ago. They shall not be revealed to you in detail. This reticence is not achieved to spare you from boredom. It has a more selfish motive. Men in elected public office and who desire to continue there must not expose themselves to the charge that they are becoming old duffers by being unduly retrospective. They must brace themselves and turn resolutely to the future. I shall, and soon, but not before pulling one memory out of the bag and letting you know that some of that very solid concrete that was demolished with such difficulty in Old Main was mixed by hand by Dr. Barker. The doctor was not among the very first students here, but he was not far behind, and the honor you do me today is shared equally by my wife, Vitie, whose student days were contemporaneous with mine. I add quickly that there was somewhat of a variance in our scholastic ability, and if the doctorate were based solely on merit, Vitie, not I, would be its recipient. I make this admission because if I didn't do so, the truth might be revealed by President Patty, who taught us both. Now the fact is that those words were written when I thought Vitie would be here with me today, and that I would thus build up capital in my local bank by contributing those words. As President Patty said, she was prevented by illness from coming. But if I may be allowed a personal note, I want to express my deep, deep appreciation for my firstborn, Mrs. Burke Riley, coming here from Juneau to be with me today on the day that I am so honored. It was a different world back in those days. Not long before, the world had been engulfed in war, but there was to be no more war. We had sought to make the world safe for democracy, but we wanted little more to do with it, save and accept as tourists to Paris. Fascist, Nazi, these words were unheard of by us. Bolshevism was a strange experiment whose purposes were clouded outside Russia and perhaps even there. We sought refuge from the world's ills and ignorance. By some mysterious process, we believed these ills would disappear if we did not deign to diagnose them. Now the world has altered, but it is no less strange and fascinating because of its changes. Now distance in terms of warfare has an entirely different connotation. Oceans no longer constitute moats. Now men have the capacity to destroy mankind itself by nuclear holocaust. Now the United States acts as freedom's shield, and by the example of her people must be the mentor and standard of democracy. a mighty military power, firmly committed to the proposition of giving comfort and succor and money, especially money, to those allied with us, or those we hope will be allied with us, the United States moves uneasily and uncertainly at times in the area of world democracy. We make some strange decisions, and then again, decisions come from us inspired by the innate decency that has always marked our people. I spoke about strange decisions. In doing so, I had a special concern with the Pentagon judgment of the other day that has dictated that in Alaska, there shall be a radical cut in aircraft fighter strength. One of two such squadrons in the entire state is to go, or so we are told. And this at a time when our relationship with the people to the West has deteriorated so recently and so alarmingly because the Soviet premier has so willed it. This Pentagon judgment is a wrong judgment, a flighty judgment, and a dangerous judgment. I take my theme this day from the recent and alarming event, which has so shattered the hopes of the world for peace. We had looked forward with a measured degree of optimism to a lessening of tension, which had been building up over the years, layer by layer, almost to the breaking point. Now the leader of the Soviet government has, in response to God knows what pressures or desires, seen fit in loud and angry and unreasonable words to end the summit conference, which he was so instrumental in promoting even before its real beginning. The hard truth is that we are now living in a world at war. There is an unalterable conflict between our beliefs and those that the communists live by. Necessity may reduce the overt expression of that conflict, and practicality may compel the Soviet to deviate at times from the rigid communist doctrine. The conflict between their creed and ours, however, is as basic and enduring as the conflict between truth and error. We regard communism as merely a variation on the old age theme of dictatorship. But in presenting their beliefs to the yet uncommitted peoples, the communists have a great advantage, which we had best recognized. That advantage lies in the fact that communism is a system worked out to every detail. This system, besides the utopia it promises, has very concrete ideas, readily adaptable for every nation and people. Moreover, the uncommitted people, yearning for some change in their present conditions, can identify the communist cause with a new and promising fulfillment of their just aspirations. It is more difficult for them to understand that ours is a dynamic, progressive society which changes to meet new problems without losing faith with the basic principles that gave it birth. Democracy, of course, is not primarily a system at all, but a set of values. The chief of these values is that the individual human being is a creature of infinite worth. Government, therefore, must protect and aid the individual. Some concessions may be asked of him, but he must never be sacrificed for the good of the state, the future, the proletariat, or any cause whatsoever. Our ideas of self-government, majority rule, popular sovereignty, all derive from the concept that government is an instrument for service. Communism does not believe in the individual except as a finite part of the whole, existing for the state rather than the state for him. Democracy offers a method of making community decisions in a climate for ideological competition. Ours is the faith of Milton. Let truth and falsehood grapple. Whoever knew truth, put to the worst in a free and equal encounter. We can explain ourselves only by our example. Since one of our beliefs is in local self-government, government by those most nearly concerned whenever possible, the achievement of statehood by Alaska marks a very important step in the kind of demonstration I have in mind. This, then, is an awesome duty of Alaska as a new state. We must, having in mind all the accumulated experiences of democracy to this time, fashion a state which shall so nearly express our belief that we can show the world a model workshop wherein the values we honor are practiced. Our founding fathers committed these United States to what they believed the best possible government. If we still believe in that commitment, we must strive to express it in our daily lives. In this respect, Alaska is no different from older states, except in this. We are, as a new state, less hampered by traditions that may be confused with righteousness because they are old. We can look forward more clearly on every proposed new step and decide whether it truly fulfills our beliefs. And it is our duty to make such a searching appraisal of each new step. The decade of the 50s in America has been characterized as one of self-indulgence. Our people, especially the young, sought escape from the burden of worry and responsibility imposed upon a free people in a Cold War, in a nuclear world. Our mood, in fact, was almost reminiscent of the attitude which pervaded America in the 1920s. We sought refuge in suburbia, a washer-dryer, two cars, a secure job, a ranch house. It is interesting, and it may be fruitful, to ponder the reasons for that move. The sacrifices made necessary by war are gladly rendered by Americans, but the sacrifices of sustained, conscientious citizenship in a troubled world are less dramatic, although equally important. These sacrifices we did not make in the 50s. In short, while we offered much in terms of money, especially to the world at large, we failed somehow to offer the most precious offering in our power, our attention. Some of us gave it, to be sure, but most of us did not. The 60s must be different. The world does not owe us happiness. We owe it and ourselves service of the highest moral order. Our two-car families must not think of the years ahead as a time to acquire their third car. We must be willing, if necessary, to sacrifice all these comforts for the values we honor. It may be, in the years to come, we shall have to make such sacrifices to maintain freedom in a world at strife. It is well to remember that Russians are devoting far more of their national production to science, to capital improvements, to their military establishment, and to education, and far less to consumer goods than we. We must reject absolutely the contention expressed recently by an important United States official that we are in business to produce consumer goods. And as long as they are coming out in volume, all is well in America. Was this the reason for the sacrifices at Valley Forge? Was this why our countrymen have always gathered in collective nobility when our nation has been threatened and they were taken to the summits of endeavor by great leadership? The question answers itself. We have boasted before the world of the material comfort this consumer goods our system has given us. This is very well if we mean to say to others less fortunate, we shall help you too to attain this high standard of living. But we must take care to avoid a misconstruction of our way of life. The beauty of America does not lie in material wealth. It lies in freedom. We cannot pause for the leisurely enjoyment of our riches when half the world is hungry for food and freedom. We cannot pause because the Soviet Union will not wait for us. But more important, we cannot rest because in so doing, we deny what we stand for: equality and freedom of all men. Earlier I referred to the sacrifices of conscientious citizenship. But as good a justification for freedom as any others is that the democratic process is a happy process for the fortunate citizens who practice it. It sharpens wit. It offers a test for lungs and voices and hearts. Democracy not only promotes wiser decisions, but general wisdom and creative habits, which democratic citizens can apply in all their activities and dealings. Democracy is based on the idea that each man should have a voice in his government, but he must exercise that voice conscientiously, or the right, together with the duties, may be lost. This is a world in which we have to work for our blessing, and the highest values depend on the most work, eternal vigilance, exacting effort. No man is an island entire unto himself. No man can construct a private peace. Each is his brother's keeper, and it is of real importance to us. If these brothers are starving in India, or suffering under tyranny anywhere, or if our own legislature or city council is neglecting public welfare in favor of some special interest, should we falter, should we neglect our duty in this world, so interdependent, we will build our peace and happiness on shifting sand. We are all part of one another. The world is too closely knit for any isolated, self-absorbed success. And oddly, the interdependence, which all of us would concede, seems easier to apply and less demanding as we speak of our brothers starving in India than as we speak of our disenfranchised brothers in the South. The moral requirement on our part, I submit, is essentially the same. Government has become highly complex, and it is increasingly difficult to fulfill that primary duty of sustaining the human dignity of the individual. In his time, Jefferson could say that the least government is the best, because America was then an agricultural community in which each family was largely self-sustaining. But the Industrial Revolution has changed all of that. It is not so much a case of protecting management from labor, or the other way around, as a case of protecting us all from an industrial complex which will control us if we don't control it. We as a people must be prepared to act to protect individuals and groups against pressures that would curtail freedom. Unfortunately, And this is what Thomas Jefferson feared. A government that is strong enough to protect the individual is apt to interfere with his freedom. We must be on our guard, because there are voices occasionally heard insisting we abrogate our inheritance of freedom as a means of erecting a bulwark against communism. Yet we must remember what we primarily oppose in communism is not an economic system, but a concept of society in which the individual is not a real entity, a society in which only the whole people, the state, is possessed of rights. In this connection, the ordinary use of the word freedom is not sufficiently extensive. The increase which modern society, the inroads, I should say, which modern society can make upon precious individualism are not solely, or even principally, in the form of political restrictions upon those rights found in our first 10 amendments to the Constitution. They may instead take the form of pressures for conformity or of the insidious appeal of mass media. But in a political sense, it is on the state and local level where the heritage of human rights can be most effectively assured or abrogated. We in Alaska must watch carefully. In this country, the most important field in which we carry out local self-government is education. Instead of being federally controlled, our schools are controlled by the towns and school districts and the state. We must teach our children at every age how valuable our freedom is and how easily it could be lost. Our children must have the fervor and vision of our forefathers if we are to keep the liberty they won us. We must love freedom and live so as to preserve it. Our example should verify our children's lessons. Where we have imperfectly fulfilled our democracy, we must perfect it, or at a minimum, will to our children such love of liberty that will lead to correction of our mistakes and the changes necessary in a changing world, so that whatever economic and social changes the world makes, democracy itself will remain invincible. Indeed, teaching the young that freedom is a precious heritage may have far-reaching benefits. The mind that regards liberty as a precious legacy from preceding generations will be a mind which will hold in proper reverence the legacy of our arts and letters, our sciences and philosophy, our religions and our ethics, our language and our sport. To fulfill our role as a state, Alaska is committed to act with intelligence, honesty, and vision. Should any of these be lacking, we shall surely fail, even if we possess all other attributes in their highest order. It is surely obvious that the complications of today's world demand clear intelligence. Nor is there today, nor was there ever in the past, any substitute for honesty. True dedication to a high moral order and willingness to put service to such moral precepts ahead of personal gain or wishes. Vision is that combination of thought, diligence, and imagination behind all action. If vision means this and not nonsense, as the modern derogatory use indicates, let us then be visionary. Part of my vision for Alaska is this. The University of Alaska can well be the point from which these virtues come. A university in its highest function is surely a mighty force injecting moral value, intelligence, and vision into the life of the state. A university should be especially the point of vision in our society. Nowhere else is there so nearly the perfect atmosphere for thoughtful, clear examination of our goals and our methods. Nowhere else is there accumulation of material, the recorded thoughts of all men in this search for the good. But more than all else, the university is the home of that rare creativity, kindled by the friction of young enthusiasm with mature minds. The flash that comes when no age-old values, or deep, solid thoughts, or new perceptions fire in receptive and inventive brains. And the university is the place where an exchange of ideas is natural and itself creative. The thinker is the hardest worker among all working men. And now, more than ever, we need men who can and who will think overtime. This is a time of crisis, when you who can think must make the commitment to intelligence, honesty, and vision, and go out to lead our state and our people to such fulfillment of democracy as will stand proudly before the world and before our own most critical examination. Thank you.
I know I'm speaking for all of you, and I say thank you, Bob. I thank you, Senator Bartlett. It is rather striking that Father Lemieux, who spoke here yesterday, Senator Bartlett spoke today, used similar themes. It indicates that our thinking men are very much concerned about the present world crisis which faces us. And it makes all of us stop for self-examination and say, what can we personally do to help in this situation? When Bob was speaking, I would think, what can the University of Alaska do to help in this situation? And by the University of Alaska, I mean the administration, the faculty, and the students. We are facing the same, in education, we're facing the same stiff competition from the Russian government. And it behooves all of us to be sure that they don't outdistance us. Thank you very much.
Richard Rasmussen, this is the largest class in the history of the university.
To those of us who have worked with them, they are not faceless people in cap and gown. We know something of the struggle and sacrifices that they have made and the hard work that's been involved to bring this victory to them. This is an exceptionally excellent class, a fine group of young men and women, and I'm very proud and happy to present them to you. And sir, on behalf of the faculty of the University of Alaska, I present these candidates for degrees in their respective departments of instruction. The registrar has certified that they have fulfilled the requirements of the various curricula, and the faculty of the university has recommended that they now receive their diplomas with all the rights and privileges appertaining thereto.
By virtue of the authority in me vested as president of the Board of Regents, and upon the recommendation of the president and the faculty, I confer upon you the degrees to which you are entitled with all the rights, privileges, and honors pertaining thereto.
They request that the audience withhold applause until the last degrees are conferred. For the degrees of Bachelor of Arts, Leonard Belton is absent. Joan Foster. Sandra Edwards. Kay Hitchcock. Sheldon Dubner. Howard Kantner in absentia. Ruth Leinbach. Peter C. Lynn. Richard Lindcomen. Dora McLean. Gail Raymond. Peter Reeder. Matt Stranger. Martin Wood. For the degree Bachelor of Business Administration, Donald Abel. Oscar Apostle. Howard Benson in absentia. Francis Brown. Monty Gady. Francis Fran. Matthew Berzawa. Joseph Lemon. Audrey Lee. Richard Reed. Catherine Wright. John H. Smith. Everett Wynn. For the degree Bachelor of Science and Bachelor of Education, James Albarn. Helen Jane Baker in absentia. Elvine Bancroft. Kara Bauman. Jacqueline Rizzolari. Robert Browning. Carol Bush. Alice Church.
Biological science.
Andrew Raymond. Biological science. Carl Raymond. Carol Roth, home economics. Robert Rader, geologist. Linda Taylor, general science. Ronald Leal, civil engineering. Robert Weimer, civil engineer. With a degree, Master of Arts, English, and at Fort. For the degree, Master of Education, Alma Lump. Nathan Science and Wildlife Management, Thomas O'Farrell. For the degree, professional degree, civil engineer, Robert Schmidtman, in absentia.
Graduating seniors who have been in residence four semesters or more, and who have demonstrated their scholastic ability through maintaining high grade point averages, are graduating with honor. A gold cord symbolizing this honor will be awarded to each. Will the following seniors who will graduate cum laude please rise and come forward? James Brown, Matthew Kurzawa, Joseph Lemon, Bryden Moon,
Professor of Military Science and Tactics, Assistant Professor of Military Science and Tactics, present the candidates for Army commissions. Major Barry. Will the candidates for commissions in the United States Army Reserve please rise and come forward? President of the United States, reposing special confidence in your patriotism, valor, fidelity, and ability. Upon successful completion of the Senior Division ROTC course at the University of Alaska, has appointed you Second Lieutenant in the Army of the United States. Distinguished military graduates to be commissioned are as follows as they are named. Donald Abel. Joseph Baldwin. Robert Browning. Michael Miller. Richard Reeves. Robert Weimer. Graduates to be commissioned are as follows. James Alguire. Donald Boyce.
County, Katy. Howard Coons, Jr. Brian Larman. Carl Peterson. Andy Ramos. Of the group you have just seen commissioned, one of them will be commissioned in the regular Army of the United States, Donald Abel. I'd like to recognize one other senior who will be commissioned this summer at the completion of summer camp. And would you please stand, Charles Kennedy? Thank you very much.
At this point, the president of the university is supposed to present a charge to the graduating class. I've spent some years in Canada and am impressed with their idea of using a form of toast on all gala occasions. So this is a gala occasion, and so since I, too, am graduating with you this morning, I'm going to offer a toast to each of you. First, that you have received at this university the inspiration of truth in all its native power and beauty, and find in it perpetual place to spread its transforming influences throughout the world. Second, that you have been so thoroughly intrigued with the works of nature and of your own being that you may feel, understand, and know that there are immutable laws designed in infinite wisdom, constantly operating for our good, and that you will live in strict conformity with these laws. These words I have just spoken are not my own. They are the words of Peter Cooper when he founded Cooper Union, a great engineering school in New York, 100 years ago. I have repeated them because they have greater impact today. And now, a few words of my own. That in all things you do, you will ask God's help and take Him into full partnership with you. That this will give you power and understanding far beyond the efforts of the puny power of men. There is a basic truth. Nothing worthwhile is done alone by man. That you will never undervaluate yourself, but that you will always have great courage in everything you attempt, and that you will seek to develop your full potential. You are greater than you know. And then, another toast, that you will learn early in life that the only ones among you who will be really happy are those who will serve. Great wealth will not bring happiness. Look about you in life. The people who taste real happiness are those who serve others. Also, that you will always have a zest and a vitality for life. A zest and a vitality for life. I want to underscore those two words. And that beauty and enthusiasm will always be a part of your life. And that you will remember that just about the time we learn to make the most of life, the most is gone. With these thoughts, we wish you Godspeed on your journey into life. And we want each of you to always feel close to you, to this university, and to your friends of this morning. Good luck, and God bless you, and welcome to the Fellowship of Educated Men and Women. I'll ask the audience now to join with me in applauding our seniors and graduates.